Congratulations on your initiation into the Temple of the Holy Grail. You're going to start from this point your practices of the first empowerment. And the first of these practices will be your necklace practice. And so on the first evening after this initiation, wherever that may come, you will do the first necklace practice, and you will tie the first knot in the necklace. You will bind those forces into the necklace. You will do this for each night thereafter until the time of the new moon, and follow the directions at that time that are given. Now, I want to explain to you something about the temple talisman, the sacred round that you've been given, that you must keep in a pouch. What is it made of? Well, one of the important elements of it is earth, which is, of course, ground-up minerals. But this earth is taken from 7 inches down in the earth in sacred places from all over the world, all over the United States and all over Europe. There are samples from Spain and Portugal and from Africa and from all over the U.S., and places like Mount Shasta and Grand Canyon. And they have been mixed also with spring water taken from these sacred locations. And this has taken years and years to make and to collect. And at each of these locations, the elemental and elementary beings that live and rule in these places have been recruited and brought in to become part of the egregor of this temple, to become part of the great work of human and planetary transformation and self-evolution. And they are part, on the elementary level, of the egregor of this temple. And also other things have gone into the making of this. It has to do with rosemary that is picked on the exact full moon and is treated in a certain way, and with the sacramental pomegranate juice that's been consecrated in the Grail liturgy, and many other things, and many rituals that have been performed, guidance that's been given that comes from very ancient times on the making of this very special telluric kind of talisman. And this talisman, after it's been consecrated and activated during your initiation, becomes the physical means through which empowerments and other things are contacted for you. You wear this, of course, in a pouch that hangs directly over your monadic heart center. You wear it only when you meditate and do your attunements or practices in the morning, and you wear it when you are doing your empowerments and operating the liturgy of the Holy Grail or doing any grail rites. But you do not wear it at any other time. You don't wear it while you sleep. You don't wear it during the day. You don't wear it at any other times. You don't expose it to water, because the substances in it could be damaged by water, and you certainly don't want anybody to step on it. You also don't want anyone but yourself touching this. So you keep it in the pouch, and then keep the pouch in your silver chalice for safekeeping, or on your altar, someplace where no one can get to it. Now, there are two other things that you may put in the pouch with this at certain times. During the second part of this empowerment, when your necklace has been wrapped up into a ball, you will put that in the pouch and wear it over your monadic heart center, along with the talisman, when you do your practices. And then you'll remove it on the full moon and completely incinerate it as per directions. And the other thing you will want to wear in that is your long life stone. When you do the long life practices, you will wear the long life stone in that place. And you might want to keep the long life stone in there permanently, although you don't need to have the long life stone after you have cultured and developed the empowerment. You don't need to be wearing the stone to do it. But as a first order initiate, you will always use the talisman for all work. If you do advance by going through the home temple priesthood and coming in as a priest ultimately, and you would do advance to the second order, you will not need to wear your talisman at that point. All the forces of the talisman will be integrated into who and what you are. And it will be a very different thing. And when you, if you go on to become a bishop in the home temple priesthood and become a grail bishop or a grail priest, but if you become a bishop, you will also be able to do other kinds of things without benefit of the talisman, and the talisman will become something that you simply keep in a special place on your altar. But for all first order work, you're going to be using the talisman and then keeping it safe and storing it and so on. The talisman is a very unusual thing. It represents the fact that we, as Templars, are bringing the higher down into the lower. We are not trying to elevate ourselves out of the lower world to leave behind this flesh and this imperfect state. We are instead trying to bring heaven into earth. We are trying to sanctify the flesh. We are trying to bring ourselves into a new and more powerful and sanctified incarnate state. And we are to be as Christ's in flesh doing that work. And that is the symbol of the talisman, that we actually use a physical substance and we wear it over our monadic heart center, and it connects us microcosmically and macrocosmically. Now, the studies for first empowerment are quite extensive, and they have to do very much with a basic, we might call it Gnostic or Kabbalistic, orientation to reality. Reality, as we see it and perceive it through our senses, is much as we would see ourselves in a mirror in a funhouse. The things that are small are made big, and the things that are big are made small. Everything is inverted. Everything is backwards. It's not a world of total illusion. It's simply that there are correspondences, but the correspondences don't relate in a direct way. That which is loud and obvious and coarse and seems most powerful in this world is in fact that which is least real and has the least power and the least staying power and the least eternal reality of anything. And that which seems very subtle and very often having no effect is that which in fact is the great and eternal and powerful thing. And that is a basic thing to know. Yes, the below does reflect the above, but it reflects it. And like a reflection in a mirror, everything is backwards. Everything is inverted. I'd like you to turn to page 17 in your first empowerment manual and take a look at the constitution of the human microcosmic body. Notice that we're talking only about details of the physical, astral, and mental planes, which are the what we call the inverted reality, the world below the firmament, so to speak, the world that we are aware of which only one part is visible to us, but the world that is not part of what might be called the supermundane world. Notice that in the physical plane, we have earth, water, and air type of things that are visible to us. The air is the least visible. It involves dissolved gases and things like this. And by air, earth, and water, we don't mean just what we call earth and air and water. We mean the energies of these things. But when we get to the energy of fire, we have a fourfold division. These are the ethers, the chemical ethers, the vital ethers or pranas, the luminous ethers, and the reflective ethers. These are the elements of our aura, the invisible aura, and they connect us to a higher realm, ultimately the astral planes. And it's in the astral plane that we have two major distinctions, the lower astral and the higher astral. And in the lower astral and in the lower mental regions, we have the hells. We have the preteradrenal and infernal and proctodrenal places of beings that are inverted beings, beings that take pleasure at human suffering, take honest, joyful pleasure at human suffering, and sometimes caused people to do this to other people in wars, in perverted acts of violence and so on that you read about in the newspaper. These beings inhabit these, and they're not just tricksters. They're absolute anti-types to humanity. And they are part of what we need to deal with in the what we call the empowerment over dark forces. In the higher planes of the mental world is where we find what we call the higher self, the higher nature, the egoic lotus, or the what we've known as the egoic chalice. And it is in that region that we seek to make connections through the antikarana, the spirali that connect our lower senses to our higher senses, and our lower realities to the higher realities, and our lower perceptions to the higher perceptions that we've spoken of before. In the first empowerment, you're going to be building a tripartite aquaster, the mirror, the shield, and the beast. This is basically an astral body that you are creating for yourself, and it's being created out of etheric substance. And this work that you do will be of great value to you. It will allow you not only to protect and defend and to track down sources of attack and so on that come against you, but also that come against others. And it will allow you to be able to protect others, because eventually when you get to be rather difficult to get to, these forces will try to get to you through others that are near to your heart. However, a year from now, you will do another empowerment called the Antikarana Building Empowerment. And when you do that, you will build another structure, but it will not be an aquaster. It will not be an astral structure. It will exist in the higher mental planes as part of the egoic lotus. And it will be a structure that is there already in seed form that you will facilitate and that you will help to bring to birth. And that structure will complete an awful lot of your higher psychic structure for the work of this first order. Now I'm going to play tapes that were made for a group of initiates in 1992 or 1993 about the first empowerment. The entire point of initiation is the empowerments. The empowerments are here to help you, to augment you, to expand you, to help you progress so that the kind of service and kind of work you do in the world for the progress of humanity and of nature can be amplified in your own sphere. That is why the temple is not a lodge, and it is not like an initiatic group of the older types from Europe. It is, in fact, a network of people, and after initiation, and in the case of many people, even including initiation, there may be no physical contact. Much of the contact is telepathic. Many of us communicate on electronic media like the computers through electronic mail and things like this, and that very much enhances the telepathic contact. But we have no obligation to work together as a group on any one concerted project or to convene at any particular time. There are no attendance requirements. We simply progress at our own pace according to lunar and solar cycles through the empowerments, and we do our part of the great work as we are guided. Your work now is to complete your qualification as an initiate by going through the work and the operations of the first empowerment. They consist of two parts, except in the case of certain third-order people who need not do the first part. The first part is what we call the necklace technique. It is work that is done from the full moon of Wesak to the new moon over 2 weeks, and that is described rather much in detail in the writings. The point of this work is to make yourselves very clear and very aware of the working of the subliminal telepathic dark guidance
of the dark forces that are always at work in human consciousness and around all things, to identify them, not just by finger pointing and say, oh, there it is out there, by finger pointing, no, at yourself and saying, here's where I have been taken in, here's where I have been suckered in to this energy. And by binding it through making a loop and a string and doing this for 2 weeks, at the end of which time, this is wound in a sacred way through a certain kind of piercing of thread through the loops. And the thread is a yarn, a violet yarn that has been permeated by the sacrament. And it is wound into a ball that is then worn along with the temple talisman for morning practices over the monadic heart center. And then, for the next 2 weeks, from new moon to the full moon of Christ in humanity, a practice is done each morning, a visualization, the point of which is to self-generate a tripartite aquaster. Now, this aquaster is an organ, a new organ that you are creating out of your aura, so to speak. It's created out of the etheric and other magnetic fluidic materials that exist in your animal soul and in your physical body and all of its radiations. Based upon the mineral, vegetable, and animal lives that you have led, whose seeds and forms you carry within you and are therefore able to develop on the occult level. These three elements are the mirror, which will be set up at the perimeter of your auric egg and made of the most intelligent, the highest Arcades, containing the most Iliaster type of mineral that you have the relationship with that has appeared to you in the parameters of the vigil. It may be a clear quartz, it may be some sort of a gemstone, but a glassy type stone of some sort. That will be the material for the mirror. The shield is made from the vegetative material that relates to you and that you have been part of and that you contain the seeds for, preferably some kind of tree, woody tree, and it can be a soft wood or a hard wood, but the basic entity of all vegetative material lies in the higher and in the middle mental planes. And the shield is an intelligent shield. It has very interesting powers. It is able to intercept that which the mirror cannot reflect and deflect, and that happens sometimes, especially when attacks are made upon you through another person, and that person is harmed. And although you will feel the shock of these attacks, they won't go deeply into you, but the impression from them will be left on the shield, which is contained, so to speak, within the auric mirror. And this will enable you to then go back to the source of that attack and to disperse it. And then there is what we call the beast, which must be some kind of mammal of prey that is flesh-eating, meat-eating, and terrifying. A lion, a panther, or a tiger type of thing, a wolf, a bear, some kind of creature like this that you are and have been, that can instantly multiply into an infinite number of beasts, and that guards you continually just as a dog at the doorstep would do, and that can also be sent out on missions to destroy and dissipate attackers. It is even possible, in the case of certain people, depending upon how strong you become, to destroy members of the Dark Brotherhood who, according to many eons of time, have been immortal. They have been able to sustain themselves alive and supposedly will not dissolve until the next great period of the world. But it is actually possible sometimes to defeat and destroy and dissolve such entities. This, however, is not a normal occurrence, but it can be done. But the main purpose of the beast is protection, And protection very often involves offensive as well as defensive measures. The beast can also be assigned to protect other people, because very often attacks upon you will come through other people, through loved ones, through projects, through other kinds of things. So how you develop the use of this new organ that you will be self-generating will be taught to you telepathically in dreams, and it will come to you by inspiration. Now, many of you will say to yourselves, well, gee, I've spent all these years learning to resolve duality and to leave duality behind, and what is all this stuff about dark forces and spiritual bad guys and all this kind of stuff? Well, it's very much what St. Paul spoke about in his letters about the powers and principalities that we war against, when he spoke of the armor that we must don in order to successfully battle them. It is much of what is spoken about in the Agni Yoga and many, many other writings. It is what is spoken about in the Bhagavad Gita. There is spiritual warfare on this level of reality. If we were to understand reality, divine reality, as what it truly is, then nothing that we see or sense or know or can understand or can perceive is divine reality. What we live in is duality, and we live in what we call the created or reflected worlds. We think in them, we sense in them, we exist in them. But we exist and have our being only by virtue of that which is divine, that we reflect. And because of that fact, we have to work towards that from the place we are, and we therefore have to work within the context of duality, and we have to fight the battles, just as Arjuna was advised by Krishna to go ahead and do his dharma and fight the battles. Even though he was a wise man and was way beyond fighting and battles and all these sort of things, we too must do these things, and we must protect people, we must protect ourselves. As we start working in this level, we'll become moving targets for attacks. We will generate enough light that we will become a threat to many of the powers that be. And these powers are of many sorts and many kinds. They're all generated by humanity. Everything that we have generated, they are kind of the psychic product of the human process of evolution in flesh, and they exist around us in the noosphere everywhere, and they are rooted in and from our past, and they must be overcome. And very often it is much as though we were engaged in warfare or a battle and strife of that nature. And the only way that we can overcome in a situation where the enemy is invisible is to become aware of what this is. Ultimately, we have one great and final battle, and that is the battle against what has been called the dweller on the threshold. And that is ultimately what this battle is all about. So the empowerment over dark forces, which was given by the Master Jesus to 70 of his disciples, and which they received in various degrees of power according to their purity and their development, this is what we now take formally as an empowerment, and the means by which we do it. We are self-generating a new organ, a psychic organ of psychic working and of spiritual working. Now, many of you are familiar with Tibetan tonkas, where you see, for example, the great, what I call the Diamond Christ, Padmasambhava. And you see him perhaps in one corner of the tonka in his, what is called his terrible aspect, where he has the face of a monster and flames go all around from him and so on. And you have perhaps wondered what this really represents. Well, this represents the aspect of Padmasambhava when he has his psychic organ of self-defense and offense fully activated. Many Tibetan lamas, you will notice, have emblems of lions or tigers on their gowns or somewhere around the the area or the paraphernalia they carry with them. It's been true in deep occult traditions that those who do the serious and deep work of the planet have developed on the psychic and the interior levels an organ of protection. And that is what you must develop in the first empowerment. I'll let you read the words of the empowerment materials and read between the lines, and you'll understand more and more about it. But the practices are very simple and very clear. They are the practices for the creation of an aquaster, and they are done with the Aum. They are done with visualization. They are done using the temple talisman, and they are done in daily practice, in a rhythmic daily thing over a lunar cycle. Now, when you do the practice and the visualization for each element of this tripartite aquaster, each one has to be established with the creative Aum. It's done on the tone of the F sharp. This particular tone is an E. So if you can sing an E, you can sing an F sharp, which is exactly one whole tone above it. Aum. With the M held as long as the A. Is appropriate. The importance is the activity of the throat and the will, the visualization, and the temple talisman. The mudra of divine self-generation and creation, and the mudra of using will to manifest, the mudra of manifestation, is with the left palm, with the first three fingers tented, pointed up like a tent, held together over the heart, the monadic heart center, and in this case, over your talisman. And the right hand extended about 45 degrees up and about 45 degrees out, with all fingers curled, the three outer fingers curled in, the pointer finger pointing out, and the thumb straight ahead. So your first two fingers are straight ahead, and especially your pointer finger. And then the intoning of the Aum with the proper visualization in a very sacred way. That is the mudra and the means for manifestational use of the Aum. The practice that is done with the necklace technique is done at night after sunset. Before you go to bed or go to sleep, you think back and you recollect what you've done during the day, and that's when you make your record and your bindings. Of course, you do your regular morning meditation, the Iliaster meditation, and what other practices you have in the morning each day. But when you come to the new moon, now the practices of the self-generation modality are done in the morning after you have done your meditation and evoked the white light of the Iliaster. That is when, after you have attuned and evoked the white light of the Iliaster, that is when you do this evocational work with the tripartite aquaster. Needless to say, it must be done regularly and faithfully every morning and with all of your attention and all of your heart in it. Now, three things are necessary to set the parameters for the actual empowerment, and this will be true in all empowerment. First, you must have completed all the practices necessary for the empowerment. Second, you must create the field for the activity. You must set up the divine parameters that is done by the invoking of the liturgy of the Holy Grail. And that brings into existence the parameters that can facilitate the working of the invisibles with you. And then you must sit in the Iliaster meditation with, in some cases you stand in later empowerments or in other kinds of positions, but basically you sit in the Iliastra meditation at the exact time of the moon cycle, usually the full moon, and you have the temple talisman on your monadic heart center. And you must go into that meditation no later than 7 minutes before the exact time of the moon, and keep in that meditation until no sooner than 7 minutes after the exact time of the moon. And this is done at the part of the liturgy that says grail rites. That is before the actual communion itself, but after the elements are consecrated. And then after the empowerment has been received, you commune with the elements, you give thanks, you meditate briefly, and then you do the earthing of the grail and the final blessing, and you close with the extinguishing of the candle, and then you will have received the empowerment. Now, it is necessary to do the liturgy three times for the first empowerment to be completed. The first liturgy is the liturgy you're doing now, the liturgy at Wesak, and at this time the violet yarn is permeated with the sacrament, and you will be given that to take home and begin the yarn practices, and you will also, of course, be given the new moon. But you must do it, of course, before the new moon, because at that time you again consecrate another violet yarn, which is taken through the sacrament in the liturgy, and that then is used to pierce all the loops that you have created in the first yarn. And then the first yarn is tied end to end, and the whole thing is wrapped up very tightly as a ball using the second yarn. And then finally, when it's very tight, the ends of the second yarn are tied. And then after it is dried, it is used in the self-generating tripartite aquaster practices. The very first practice that you do, and this is terribly important, for the generation of the aquaster must be done at the exact time of the new moon, and you have to do that day or night, whenever that is. It could be in the middle of the night, it could be in the middle of the day. You do that, and then from then on, in the morning, with your morning practices, you continue that that visualization and the alming. When you come to the end of that, when the 2 weeks are completed and it is the time of the full moon of Christ in humanity, at that time you again do the liturgy. You incinerate completely the yarn ball on a consecrated charcoal or in some kind of concentrated very hot flame, and you earth the ashes into the ground 7 inches under in the earth, and you receive the empowerment as described through meditation with the grail talisman from 7 minutes before to 7 minutes after the exact time of the full moon. Complete the communion and the earthing of the grail and the blessing and the extinguishing of the candle, and then you will have received the empowerment. Now, I should say that receiving an empowerment is just like receiving a seed. You have to germinate it and bring it into being. So this empowerment is just the very beginning of something quite important that you will build in yourself. And it will be built by conflict, and it will be built by failure as well as by success and by much experience. And it doesn't mean that once you've received the empowerment that you're an all-powerful vanquisher of dark forces. It simply means that you are now equipped, just as a page is equipped to accompany the squire who accompanies the knight into battle. And so you are... have received your basic equipment to go forward in this. It also means that you are ready to begin receiving other empowerments, which you do one at a time, and I do have a suggested order of them. None of them, with the exception of root chakra empowerment, are anywhere as complex as what you've been through with the probation and with the first empowerment. They usually involve one or two tapes and a few pages of instructions and a practice that is coordinated with a lunar cycle, a very brief practice. But you are now ready to receive these other empowerments, which you may do at your own discretion. all the first order empowerments are now open to you. Again, all this is done privately at your own time and in your own space in front of your own altar. And you may choose to interact with other Templars in a group fashion, or you may not choose to do so. It is totally up to your style of being.
I sin.
As Templars, we are like those who have taken the Bodhisattva vow. We allow ourselves to be used, to be drawn upon, to participate invisibly in the salvation and liberation of the planet and of humanity.
Obsession and possession occur most typically at the time of puberty, and teenagers are the most really active targets and harbingers of these kinds of diseases. There are many people who spend their lives sacrificially working with teenagers as teachers and as counselors and working with the problems of teenagers, and they come face to face with the whole business of dark forces.
Despoiling of humanity by dark forces. And these people pour out their souls to the very ends, working to help kids and help humanity. But they cannot be successful unless there are invisible co-workers behind them who are supporting their work in ways that they cannot see and they cannot understand. Because these people, these very precious world servers who go out and do the work that needs to be done right where the rubber meets the road and get their hands dirty doing it and make themselves beautiful by doing it, they must have the spiritual support that adepts and those who understand the invisible workings of the world can give. And that is our work. Let's hear a little bit of this program. I'll put it on now.
And this surge in violence committed by kids isn't isolated to Oakland either. It's everywhere. In Union City last October, an 11-year-old, a 13-year-old, and a 16-year-old attacked Thomas Weinhofer as he waited for his daughter outside her high school. Weinhofer was stabbed to death. Last January in San Jose, three teenagers, the youngest just 15 years old, broke into a home to burglarize it and ended up killing 8-year-old Melvin Anchetta, who was home sick at the time. Teenagers are expelled from school every week for taking guns into class. Santa Clara County's deputy district attorney, who supervises the prosecution of juvenile suspects, says it's bad and getting worse.
We've seen an enormous rise over the last couple years, and more in particular in the last 6 months. We've seen a rise in the violent crime rates. It seems to be doubling over the last few months.
Mark Buller says in fiscal 1991, 18 kids were arrested on murder charges in Santa Clara County. The next year, that number jumped to 30. So far this year, teenagers are suspected in 33 murders. And Buller says the dramatic rise in the teenage murder rate can't be blamed on gangs either. He says in many cases, the suspects in these brutal murders appear to be everyday kids.
It goes to all economic groups, all social classes, all races. It has no barriers or boundaries, this violence. No matter where you are subject to violence by teenagers.
And for parents, Buller says the really frightening thing is a rise in violence by teenagers translates to a rise in violence against teenagers, an opinion which is shared by kids on the street.
Sometimes it scares me, really, because you never know what's going to happen. You never know if you're living the next day or whatever. You know, when you're a child, you know, you go to school and whatever. You have to worry about these things, but now you have to consciously, you know, look over your shoulder.
What do you think the chances are that you'll get into some kind of trouble, that you'll get hurt or something between now and when you're a senior?
I think it's a good chance that something might happen.
Educators like Mike Janvier know that something can happen long before a kid's senior year. Janvier's the principal at Alameda's Lincoln Middle School, where some parents used to think the biggest problem was graffiti on the bathroom walls.
Checking up on one student in particular, found a marker and also found a gun.
You're checking his backpack looking for marking pens?
That's correct. Found a gun and then started to dig as deep as possible, checking lockers, checking close friends, listening very carefully to what students were saying. And in the course of the end of the day Thursday and early Friday morning, found a second gun.
It's not what the principal of a nice little school in a nice little neighborhood expected.
Certainly have to say I was surprised. I've been in this business 20 years. I was a high school administrator here in Alameda for 4 years and never came close to finding a gun.
The fact is, packing a pistol along with lunch is a lot more common than most parents think. A U.S. Department of Health and Human Services study found that at least 100,000 kids carry a gun to school every day.
Looking face-to-face with a gun, that was a shock.
These are little kids.
That's part of the shock. The idea that it would be okay to have possession of a gun was mind-boggling to me.
Janvier shudders to think of what could have happened if the boys met in a showdown at Lincoln Park as planned, if the usual crowd of onlookers gathered to watch. Did Principal Janvier think he was immune to this, since he teaches in a school that serves a relatively well-off community?
This is an outstanding school, both academically and the makeup of the school, the parent community. The parents are very involved here. But I also have said this over and over again, we are a public school, and we're a reflection of society.
A reflection of society at its worst can be seen in the emergency room at Oakland's Highland Hospital. Trauma surgeon Dr. Vernon Henderson.
Well, we see an awful lot of injuries to what we call the central body area.
Dr. Henderson's the one whose job it is to patch these kids up when they're wheeled into Highland's Trauma Center.
It's when you see them in the postoperative period and they're crying or they're calling for their moms or something of that nature. That really hits your heartstrings, because you realize that, no matter what these kids were out there doing, they're really just children.
Dr. Henderson says in the last 5 years, Highland Hospital has seen a 450% increase in bullet wounds among kids between the ages of 10 and 19. For him, one of the worst parts of the job is breaking it to the family. He remembers the night a 16-year-old was wheeled into the hospital with a bullet in the head.
The parents come in to see the mom and his sisters, and they're just devastated, because they touch him and they talk to him and all, and he doesn't move. And, they begin sort of very slowly to get the idea that brain death is exactly what it means, that the patient's dead.
And no matter how many times Dr. Henderson breaks this news to a mother, a father, an aunt, or a sister, he feels he never gets good at it.
You're listening to yourself talk, and then there's this crying or screaming in the background, and it's surrealistic. It really is. It's like you see yourself in that circumstance over and over and over again, and you know that you're never going to be able to do this, and you just want to hug this individual and cry with him because it really is sad.
Dr. Henderson, Principal Mike Janvier, young Nicholas Middleton, and Deputy DA Mark Fuller all want to know why this violence is on the rise among young people, and they all have their theories. A look at that when we return with our special KCBS in-depth report, Way Past Bad.
My son Michael, who is 30 years old and an educator in Portland, Oregon, tells me that every day in the city of Portland, Oregon, there are 7 drive-by shootings by teenagers. He says that to be an educator in the public schools today, you have to be an expert in gangs. You have to know who the gangs are. When you start to see the gang symbols appearing on the lavatory walls and things like that, then you know who the new gang is that's moved in. He tells me about the Crips and the other gangs from Los Angeles that have moved up I-5, and they are made of liberated minors or emancipated minors age 16, 17. They have no parents that care about them, and they move up into different cities all the way up, Portland, Seattle, and they register in the high schools, and they register a certain number of their gang in one high school and a certain number in another and a certain number in another in order to begin carving out territories where they begin selling drugs and doing prostitution and taking over certain kinds of activities, and they are armed to the teeth with automatic weapons, and they commit robberies and other atrocities. And this problem that is going on, this is just one tiny aspect of a problem that's going on all over the world in many, many different degrees. This corruption of the human spirit, this absolute devolution of civilization and humanity is perhaps being attacked most efficiently through the youth of all the countries.
And regardless of the devotion and the skill of the social agencies and social workers that try to correct and work with these already damaged situations that come along, and I as an educator am very familiar with this, they cannot be effective if they don't have the juice, if they don't have the spiritual, invisible power behind them. And most of them don't know anything about this and don't know how to hook onto it. They need patrons. They need spiritual patrons. This is the work of the Grail. It is to bring and ground into the earth the higher evolutionary forces that will allow humanity to extricate itself from its own self-generated karma, its own self-generated negative and dark forces. And this is the terrible need that we must supply, and this is the warfare that we carry on. And we carry on everything we do for ourselves, we do for humanity, and everything we do for one person, we do for all. And every light we shine in one direction shines in all directions, and every bit of sweetness we add to one little location is added to all locations. And this is the work of spirit and the work of spiritual warfare, and we must be conscious about it and continue with it. I'd like you to hear an interview with a young man who went out and shot a rival gang member multiple times, and what his memory of that is.
There are parents who would like to blame the rise in violence among kids on the music.
Homies all standing around just hanging. Some dope dealing, some gang banging.
Or on movies.
You put your wrist out where you want the bullet to go. You can't miss. You can't do that. Wrong.
Or on television.
One of the things we don't always own up to is that our society really, in a sense, has glamorized violence.
Dr. Jewel Taylor Gibbs is a sociology professor at UC Berkeley School of Social Welfare. She believes there is no one thing you can blame for the skyrocketing rate of teen violence.
The American family is overextended. The American family is very stressed out. And I think whether it's a single-parent family or whether it's a two-parent working family, there are a lot of kids home alone. There are a lot of latchkey kids, and there are a lot of kids without adequate supervision.
19-year-old Rudy Mercado says he had very little supervision when he was growing up in San Gabriel. At the age of 13, he began hanging out with his homeboys, a gang known as the San Gabriel Sangre. On the night of July 3rd, 1990, he and his homeboys left a party, drove to somebody else's neighborhood, and gunned down a rival gang member.
We were just getting high, and we decided to go through a drive-by. Since it was an enemy, you know, and we just went over to El Sereno, found somebody, and just shot him. It was a .22 rifle, shot him 18 times.
Mercado says his life has changed in the years since he shot a young man who was about to celebrate his baby girl's first 4th of July, since he was tried as an adult and sentenced to the California Youth Authority. But back then, he didn't have much heart for the man he gunned down.
He grabbed inside where he was getting shot at, you know, yelling, ah, you know. But, you know, I didn't pay attention to that. You know, just throw that out. Just know you got him, and he dropped, and he died, and we just left.
Mercado still can't say exactly why he took a gun and pumped 18 bullets into someone, and he's not at all sure why so many other kids are doing the same thing. Mercado says the movies and TV he watched didn't influence him that much, but he does say his life at home did shape his life on the street.
Maybe lack of supervision, you know, a lot of free time on my hands. Mom's always working, you know, one parent.
What did your mom do when you were younger and you started doing things that you weren't supposed to do?
She wondered why I did it, you know. Well, she, like I said, she wasn't really home, you know. She's always working. Never talked about what I did, you know, how my day went at school, whatever, you know. So she's wondering if I went to school, you know. So I knew I got to school, you know, and she figured I'd stay there. But sometimes she'd take me to class, I'd to the front door, I'd walk out the back.
There are people, many dedicated people who are working with the terrible things that are going on in the world, not just with youth, but with all kinds of things and all kinds of situations. But they are human beings. They are quickly disillusioned. It's hard to maintain your idealism. It's hard to maintain your energy and your vision over years and years. It's hard not to burn out. The people that are doing this work are great people. They're wonderful people. They need spiritual support. They need to have the Holy Grail energy, the energy and the nectars and the fragrances and the essences of divine spiritual substance directed to them and accessible to them and grounded to them and in the air and in the atmosphere around them. They don't know how to get it. They simply know what they can see with their eyes, what they can feel. They simply know ordinary human reality. They must be supported. Here's a person who is like this. I'd like you to hear a little bit about this man and what he's done.
He has been teaching for more than 40 years. He's been on the front lines, in Watts in the 60s, in Oakland in the 70s. Arthur was the moving force behind an experimental school in Cerritos, California, that offered comprehensive social programs for the entire family of each student.
The fact is that when kids graduate, very few of them get into trouble. And what we're dealing with is kids that either aren't graduating, have no hope at all. I had to try to understand these kids with no hope. They tell me that they're going to be dead anyway by the time they're 20, so why worry about what they do?
It's that sense of hopelessness that worries Arthur. His experience as an educator has led him to believe that educators must pick up where the parents leave off, making the schools a place where kids want to be. He says today, in too many schools, what kids look up to are accomplishments on the streets and not accomplishments in the classroom.
Who's the hero in the school I attend? The hero is the kid that murdered someone, went to a juvenile prison, came back, and the girls are saying to me, "Hey, Johnny's back." And, you know, in my day, Johnny was a football hero. And all the girls said, "Gee, Johnny's wonderful." These kids are heroes because they're not good. They're doing terrible things. But the other kids respect them and like them and try to emulate them.
Dean Calhoun is a public health advocate in the East Bay. She's also seen this phenomenon of the most dangerous kids getting all the respect.
I think the baddest would look the toughest, have dressed a certain way, have the most jewelry.
After spending years working in public health on injury prevention and seeing kid after kid die with a bullet in the head, Calhoun realized there had to be a better approach. So she founded Youth Alive, a public health organization dedicated to preventing violence among kids. Working with urban kids, teaching them how to lobby, how to become advocates, she's also learned why life in the ghetto feels like such a losing proposition.
Low-income youth in urban areas really feel like they don't have much. And so what they do have, what they can get, are the means of destruction rather than the means of construction.
Calhoun urges adults who look at outlaw kids with disgust to think about it. How easy is it to make the right choices when you have access to so little?
In some areas, when a young person is looking for a summer job, they can maybe call 10 of their parents' friends to find some sort of job opportunity that somebody in a corporation will say, "Okay, sure, we can squeeze you in for the summer and we can give you some money." Who does the kid call if their parent is on welfare? Or if they're the child of maybe a teenage mom who hasn't had stable professional employment, who do they call? Who do they go?
Now, we've just taken a look at one area where negative, dark, decaying, destructive, devolutionary forces have ensconced themselves in our culture and our civilization. But there are many, many, many other areas. Nature, the environment, is being ravaged. There are wars going on in Bosnia, in Africa. There is tremendous chaos at this point in the what remains of the old Soviet Union. There are similar problems in other nations, in big cities like London, and even Sydney and some of the other cities like this. There are tremendous transitionary problems in China and in other kinds of places. Africa is seriously in need with tremendous epidemics of AIDS and political violence and environmental ravage and so on. the world is in great, 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 great need, more than it ever has been, of healing, planetary, worldwide healing. And this work is a work that cannot simply be accomplished on a physical, exterior, outer level with programs, with plans, with things like this. Some good-willed people can come forth with ideas and plans, but these ideas and plans will not succeed if they do not have the basis and the foundation of divine spiritual aid, of divine help. The planet and humanity is so disconnected with its own higher nature and the higher spiritual realities that when it tries to help itself and redeem itself, it very often only puts itself into a deeper and darker condition. These dark forces, as I call them, and there are many terms, dark forces is a term I'm using generically. Some people distinguish between dark forces and other kinds of forces, but which we generally define in terms of three kinds of areas, which we call the preterodermal, the infernal, and the proctodermal. Preterodermal forces are to be distinguished very much from infernal forces. And there are different kinds of beings and different kinds of modalities of being that work in this way, that obsess, that possess, that negatively influence, that dissipate, that cause things to devolve. All these are forces generated by humanity, not by the angels, not by the divine, not by any other forces, not by external forces to this planet, but by humanity. And that's a rather general statement, and there are some exceptions to that. But in general terms, we are dealing with untying all the knots that we have tied as a race and as a series of races and as a form and modality of being. Master Jesus, when asked why the man was born blind, was it for his own sins or the sins of his parents, did not answer or address either of those propositions. Instead, he said, the man was born blind that the glory of the Divine One could be manifest in his healing. We don't need to ask, why is there violence? Why is there chaos? Why is there wickedness in the world? We don't need to ask why it is. What we simply need to do is rectify it. We don't need to ask, why is there darkness? We simply need to light the light, to shine the light. And this is the work that we must do invisibly. And when we do this work, we'll find ourselves attacked. We'll find ourselves to be moving targets. We'll find ourselves to attract all kinds and all generations and all types and species of negative force. And we will be able to deal with it. And in the dealing with these forces, we will be solving the karma and knots and untying these knots. And we will be dissolving the bonds of the world. And each thing that occurs with us and to us and through us and in our environment will become significant, not just to us, but significant in terms of the world at large and humanity at large and the planet at large. And as we link ourselves in this way into this great arena and field of evolutionary action, we will find that there is significance in every action and every word and every encounter that we have throughout the day. Some people have said, the Temple of the Holy Grail is shamanistic. You're doing shamanistic things. Of course we are. Shamanism is the paradigm. It is the basis of all the higher forms of spirituality. Shamanism is the archetype for all spiritual working and all invisible working, and none so much as in the First Empowerment, because the First Empowerment is indeed a very shamanistic field of activity. And you will each find that there are little roots in this empowerment that leads you and direct you and help you forward as you start to develop yourselves in lucid dreaming and astral working and the second order empowerment, some of which are very, very profound. And if you go ahead to begin and start the beginnings of the practices for root chakra empowerment, which is the final first order empowerment, but which is begun as soon as you wish after first empowerment, you will begin to see then with the combination of those two, first empowerment and what you learn of root chakra empowerment, you will have contained in those tremendous spectrum of what we might call earth and sky that operates on shamanic and other forms of spiritual modality that that really comprehend the totality of the first order empowerments. Little roots, little foundations for the other empowerments that will be brought along. Now, what are these other empowerments? The first empowerment I'll mention is what we call the long life empowerment, which is indeed a term that's used in English translations of Tibetan empowerments. The long life empowerment, however, is not really analogous to the Tibetan long life empowerment. Before any of us can have circumnavigated our own universes, before we as very complex psychic entities have come to terms with all of who and what we are and have, so to speak, recapitulate all of our previous formations and come to the point where we really are creating new karma and where we really are ready to build, most of us are in our 40s or maybe 50. And that means that it is necessary in this day and age for human beings to live a long time in order to become skillful and adept and useful on the physical plane. And therefore, long life and healthy life and alert life is absolutely essential for people who are on the path of mastery.
We in the temple have received from a great Tibetan master, Ganchen Rinpoche, who resides in Italy right now, both the work through telepathic teaching of the first empowerment and of the long life empowerment. In addition to that, there is the healer empowerment, and there is the heart of the master, Antarkarana building, the liturgist empowerment, and the completion of root chakra. You will learn more about each of these later.